Stanley, this is NHPR News. It's now 9:06.
Support for The Exchange Friday New Hampshire News Roundup is made possible by Centrix Bank. See beyond with Centrix Bank.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. It's our Friday New Hampshire News Roundup today in The Exchange, and here are some of the voices from the top stories this week.
We heard the blast, and the whole building kind of jumped. Then the sirens came off, and panels from the ceiling fell, and everybody evacuated, and hopefully everybody that got hurt is going to be all right.
There has been growing consensus in both political parties in both chambers that we need to address our infrastructure challenges. I praised Senator Rausch because he's come up with a thoughtful bill that has a bipartisan group of sponsors. And in its current form, yes, I would sign it.
The concept is to encourage the city of Portsmouth through our city manager to adopt a policy for all municipal employees that would protect our transgender residents or any employees who apply for office in the city.
The agreement calls for the collaboration and the creation of a path and the redevelopment of the Balsams, and it's all contingent on everything that any development plan would be contingent on, including interested third parties, final financial arrangements.
Back so soon, my faithful bird? I was sure your call I heard. I have been looking and waiting so long. I was afraid I would miss your song. But I'm happy now because you're here, and now you bring us all good cheer.
From the top, that was Mike Gaudette, an employee at the New Hampshire Ball Bearings plant in Peterborough, site of a major explosion this week. Governor Maggie Hassan speaking on The Exchange in favor of a Senate gas tax increase bill. Portsmouth Assistant Mayor Jim Splaine on his transgender rights proposal for the city. Resort entrepreneur Les Otten describing his possible purchase of the Balsams. And reading from her poetry, former National and New Hampshire Poet Laureate Maxine Cumin, who passed away on February 6th. Again, it's our Friday New Hampshire News Roundup today in The Exchange. And as we review some of the week's top stories, let's hear from you. The Exchange number is 1-800-892-6477. Email is exchange at nhpr.org. Facebook is NHPR Exchange, all one word. What's your take on some of these stories we'll be covering and others, including the House's rejection this week of expanded background checks for gun purchases and new movement on Medicaid expansion? Once again, the number 1-800-892-6477. And our guests on this week's roundup are Kevin Landrigan, political reporter for the Telegraph of Nashua. And Kevin, welcome back. Great to see you.
Happy Valentine's Day.
Also with us, Kathleen Rowane, State House reporter and politics reporter for the Concord Monitor. And Kathleen, nice to meet you. Thank you for being here.
Thank you for having me, Laura.
And also with us, Dean Spiliotis, civic scholar in the School of Arts and Sciences at Southern New Hampshire University, author of the website nhpoliticalcapital.com. And Dean, always good to see you. Thanks for being here.
Good morning, Laura.
Well, all of you, I want to ask you first about that big vote in the House on Wednesday. Kevin Landrigan, starting with you. The House rejected a bill to expand background checks by a wide margin. Was this the outcome you expected, Kevin?
Yeah, at the end of the day, it really was. New Hampshire's a very pro-gun state. It has one of the highest per capita memberships in the National Rifle Association. It has a variety of Second Amendment groups that are very vocal, very aggressive. As you know, we have background checks now. If you go to a licensed dealer, you have to go through a background check. But we're talking about a significant number of guns here that are sold at gun shows such as at the Everett Arena right here in Concord. It's one of the biggest ones in the state. At flea markets on the internet, estimates are that more than 30,000 guns are purchased this way, almost 40% of all guns. But clearly, the legislature sort of mirrors public opinion on this question. We're not Massachusetts on gun control. We're not Connecticut on gun control more than a year after the Newtown tragedy. And I thought what was most interesting about this was it was a very, very close vote on whether to amend the bill, whether to work through the bill. And then you had some sort of strategery, and by that I mean both parties agreed to do an unrecorded vote on the vote to kill the bill.
Unrecorded?
Unrecorded
Why
vote.
Is that?
It's known as a division vote because Republicans wanted to kill the bill. A lot of Democrats didn't want to be recorded as voting to kill the bill. So these Democrats would vote to amend the bill, but then when there was the unrecorded vote, it was more than 2-1 to actually vote to kill the bill. Why is that? So that a lot of Democrats could say to their gun control friends, hey, I voted to amend this bill. And they wouldn't know that they actually also voted at the end of the day to kill this bill.
Wow. That's the kind of inside stuff that it takes a long-time observer like you, Kevin, to untangle for us. Dean, correct me if I'm wrong. This bill is similar to the one that Vice President Joe Biden tried to get through Congress and failed to get through. Is that right?
That's correct, generally speaking, when we talk about background check legislation. You know, it's been interesting to me to think about this issue over the last year or so. You know, there was this initial energy in the wake of the Newtown shooting at the Sandy Hook Elementary School at the national level. As we know, the background check legislation died in the Senate. We've talked in the past about Kelly Ayotte's high-profile role in that. You know, the criticism of this particular bill had been that it would prevent individuals from sharing or selling guns to friends or family members, that they would have to go through a licensed dealer. But this particular piece of legislation actually exempted that from the process. So that would not have been a problem. And also, you know, it's interesting, they tried this, as Kevin alluded to, this attempt. They amended the bill to instead have a committee to study existing gun laws in New Hampshire. You know, I'm not a big fan of these kinds of committees. They're basically a way to kind of kick the issue down the road a bit and keep it alive. So it's just fascinating the extent to which any attempts at any kind of reform are met with very strong opposition. It's true we have a pro-gun culture, or at least a libertarian culture in the state, but I've been amazed both locally and nationally at kind of the organization and the power of these groups to block any kind of reform on the issue.
Well, just real quickly, Kathleen Ronayne, you were there watching this. What jumped out at you from this whole debate at the State House over this big gun bill?
Well, what was interesting is the study commission that Dean just mentioned. A lot of Democrats thought that it was written in a way that it would stack it in favor of people opposed to further gun restrictions. Because the way it was set up, it would have put 3 House Democrats, 3 House Republicans, and then it would have allowed the president of the Senate to appoint somebody to it. So a lot of Democrats were saying, well, you're essentially stacking this in favor of Republicans and people who might be more anti-gun regulations. So even some Democrats who didn't want to see this bill completely die, I think ultimately ended up voting against it anyway because they didn't want what they saw as a stacked study commission.
Wow. Well, the politicking around this is a lot to unravel. And Kathleen, I wanted to ask you about another story that you were watching outside, far outside the State House. Early this week, lots of people were shocked by a story out of Peterborough, an explosion at the New Hampshire Ball Bearings plant there. NHBB is a major New Hampshire manufacturer, an employer. They also have a facility in Meredith, if I understand correctly. What do they do, Kathleen, and what do we know now about what might have caused this explosion?
Well, a newspaper out of Peterborough had reported that it was caused by a nitric acid reaction. So it was an industrial error, and the fire marshal's office has ruled that that's what caused the accident. And I know that they were also going to be sending people back to work in the factory on Thursday, per that story. So I think that, you know, they still have to figure out what happened, exactly what happened. It was obviously quite a dangerous situation. They have a lot of, you know, dangerous materials that they're using in there. So, and it was apparently the worst industrial accident in at least 40 years in the company. That's what the president, who's based out in California, told one of the local papers here. So it was pretty serious. And they have counselors set up to talk with employees who witnessed it or who were there. And they've also agreed to continue paying anyone who can't come back to work as they clean this up, or the people who are injured. So I think there's still a long way to go until we completely figure out what happened. But they have at least an idea right now, and they're taking steps to get the factory back into operation.
It was a pretty shocking story. You want to jump in there, Kevin, first?
Yeah, I just wanted to say that what's amazing about this explosion is that it wasn't more serious than it became. I mean, think about this. We're talking about a plant with millions of small metal projectiles in this company. Richard Verney used to be the owner of New Hampshire Ball Bearing, a big Republican campaign contributor. So I made a number of tours at that plant with former Republican governors, Judd Gregg and Steve Merrill. It's a pretty impressive place. A lot of it is still not automated, but they have some automation. They're a really dedicated workforce. It just, as soon as I heard it, I thought, there's got to be fatalities here with all of this metal flying around, and any of these projectiles striking anybody in the wrong place, it could kill them. 15 injured, 2 airlifted to Boston hospitals, we believe with some pretty serious burns, but there were some harrowing tales told by employees out in the parking lot about ducking down and seeing the walls just cave in front of them and yellow fire flames coming over their heads. Pretty hair-raising stuff.
It seems like from another era, Kevin,
it
right?
It really does.
You know?
Oh,
yeah.
Absolutely.
Dean, you want to
jump
in?
Yeah, I mean, you essentially had the ingredients for what you typically find in improvised explosive devices. So in a sense, it was sort of an industrial version of an IED with all the ball bearings and other parts. A couple quick comments. I thought the first responder response was phenomenal. There was something like 100 firefighters and first responders there in terms of all the towns in the area responding. Good response from the state. Maggie Hassan was on top of it, monitoring events, which is always important for a governor. I think the response was good. I saw the company president talking yesterday, and he very heartfelt. He did a good job of focusing on the people who were injured and kind of leaving everything else to sort of sort itself out, which, you know, was good to hear that, and it was also sort of smart from a public relations perspective. I thought his comments sort of fit well with the tenor of the explosion.
All right. Well, and you mentioned Governor Hassan. Coming up in just a moment, Governor Hassan told us on Monday she would sign a Senate bill, to raise the gas tax by 4 cents and tie future increases to inflation. So coming up, let us know if you think that's a good idea or not. A gas tax increase, good idea or not? Give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Facebook is NHPR Exchange, all one word.
This is New Hampshire Public Radio, 919. Good morning. NHPR reaches listeners all over New Hampshire. If you own or operate a business, you can get your message to the entire state by simply becoming an NHPR underwriter. Visit the support page at nhpr.org to find out more about our many underwriting opportunities. New Hampshire weather, mostly cloudy with some snow and mixed precipitation this morning, turning partly sunny this afternoon in southern counties, mostly cloudy, snow showers for the rest of the state, some gusty winds developing, highs today from mid-20s to the lower 30s. Support for NHPR comes from UR members, and support also comes to us from Centrix Bank. See beyond with Centrix Bank. Customized business banking for businesses, professionals, municipalities, and non-for-profit organizations online at centrixbank.com. And the co-op food stores of Hanover, Lebanon, and White River Junction now offering growlers of craft beer at their White River Junction co-op location with a new draft each Thursday. This is NHPR.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, it's our Friday New Hampshire News Roundup, and we're covering some of the stories that made headlines this week. In just a minute, we'll talk about Governor Maggie Hassan's statement that she would sign a bill to increase New Hampshire's gas tax by 4 cents, tie future increases to inflation. We'll talk about that in just a moment. You can join us. Do you think that's a good idea or not? Do you agree with the governor? 1-800-892-6477. Email is exchange at nhpr.org. Post a comment on our Facebook page if you'd like. NHPR Exchange, all one word. Dean Spiliotis, I did want to ask you very briefly about a Supreme Court decision this week wading into the issue of federal wiretapping. Adam Mueller, with a group called Cop Block, had recorded conversations he had with several Manchester officials, including a police detective. And then this got into one of those typical things that we see these days, Dean. Anybody can record anything. And there was some dispute over whether Adam Mueller had the right to keep these recordings, the right to use them.
That's right. And the Supreme Court did reverse his wiretapping conviction. And this goes back to 2011. I'm not a lawyer, but this apparently hinged on the different meanings between willfully engaging in secret wiretapping versus purposely engaging in wiretapping, that the law uses the word willful, which I guess is a higher standard for disregard of the law in taping than purposely, which is the weaker standard that was used by prosecutors. So, you know, again, this is one of those sort of, in theory, it could be spun as kind of a First Amendment issue. You know, this individual is obviously monitoring, you know, public officials and their behavior. It was dealt with a police officer who was accused of roughing up a Manchester student. So he recorded, as you mentioned, these conversations with police and school officials. But yeah, I mean, it, basically the Supreme Court said that his action, while it may have been on purpose, was not a willful disregard of the law. So it's kind of a, you know, from someone who's a sort of a non-legal individual, it seems sort of like a technical distinction. But the bigger issue, as you alluded to, is it feeds into this idea that people are constantly now taping public officials, getting people on record.
Right.
And
that's really been an issue over.
Yeah, and it changes the nature of accountability in public life.
Sure. And boy, it was busy over at the state Supreme Court this week. Kathleen, the court rejected an appeal from a young man who killed two children, seriously injured another when his car crossed the median. He was texting while driving. What was the argument in this appeal, Kathleen? Not that he did it, but whether he was reckless or not? Why is this important?
Yes, it was actually a matter of language, again, and different meanings. So there's two standards. There's negligence and there's recklessness. And recklessness is a higher standard. So if you're negligent, you engage in behaviors that could be dangerous. And recklessness is knowingly engaging in those behaviors when you know they are dangerous behaviors. So I actually watched the state Supreme Court justices argue this at Concord High in front of a group of Concord High students. And what they were trying to work through were his actions that higher level of recklessness. He looked down at his cell phone, he was texting, and he crossed over the median and hit the car. So you had the prosecutors saying that, you know, he made this active choice to look down at his cell phone. He knows that's a dangerous behavior to take his eyes off the road. So therefore, it meets that higher standard. And it was interesting because the justices, as they were trying to work through this, were kind of talking about their own driving behaviors a bit. And some of them coming out and saying, I know that I've been driving before and I maybe drift out for 30 seconds. You know, it's not intentionally, but I lose focus on the road. And is this different than that? And they were working through the different levels of distraction and what is a distraction that anybody might engage in while driving, and what is something that you purposely decide to do when you know it might be more dangerous. So it sounds like they ultimately did agree with the prosecutor's argument that he made very actively a choice that he knew could injure other people, could injure himself by choosing to take his eyes off the road and read a text message.
And this was devastating for the family. I mean, three children, two dead, and the remaining son who's alive is, you know, I don't think he can speak or walk, or he's in terrible, terrible shape. So it was a devastating accident. I'm just curious, Kathleen, why were the judges talking about this at Concord High School?
They go on it's part of an On the Road series that they do where they argue, they listen to cases in front of high school students, and it's supposed to be part of an education program. And it actually wasn't just Concord High students. They brought in kids from a bunch of surrounding area schools. So I think it was, you know, history classes or U.S. government classes or something that were bussed in to listen to the justices. And they took questions from the kids after. They couldn't answer questions about the specific cases that they heard, but the kids asked a lot of questions about how they got to be a Supreme Court justice, what they do every day. So it was really interesting to watch that interaction. And some of them also asked the female justices if they ever faced sexism getting there. So it was fun to watch them engage with the students and also have the students get to witness the judicial process here in New Hampshire.
One more judicial story to ask you all about. And then I do want to talk about Governor Hassan's support for a gas tax increase and also Medicaid expansion. We'll talk about that in just a minute. 1-800-892-6477 is the number here in the exchange for you to join us. 1-800-892-6477. One more court story, though, Kevin Landergan, for you. A Superior Court this week ruled in a case that could have huge implications for the state budget and for healthcare providers concerning what's called the Medicaid Enhancement Tax. Now, just very simply, if you could, Kevin, please explain what this is.
Yeah, I'll try. The New Hampshire in 1991, under former Governor Judd Gregg, was searching desperately for money. And they came up with this idea of imposing a tax on bed revenues at hospitals. They actually called it a bed tax back then. And what you did, it was a legal reimbursement scheme. You taxed the hospital bed. That act generated matching federal dollars. And then you received so much in federal dollars, you were able to pay the hospitals back the tax money they just paid.
It's called Metascam, right?
Right, Metascam. Most states did it. Studies showed in the early 2000s that on a per capita basis, New Hampshire took more advantage of this legal loophole than any other state in the country. The hospitals were fine with this scam. We get paid back the tax. State government gets all kind of money. Then 2011 comes along, and we have another budget problem, and we have a very conservative Speaker of the House, Bill O'Brien, who says we're ending the shell game, meaning we're keeping the money.
So you pay the tax.
You pay the tax,
and
you don't
back.
Get repaid for it. So the hospitals have filed a series of lawsuits in state and federal court. This lawsuit in Rockingham County Superior Court, in which the judge ruled that the tax was unconstitutional on both state and federal constitutional grounds, was brought by New England Rehabilitation Facility in Salem. There have been, as I say, other lawsuits. We're waiting for a decision from a judge in Hillsborough County. This is big money we're talking about. It has been scaled back somewhat, but this Medicaid enhancement tax generates over $80 million a year for state government. It'd be like if we, just to use kind of a parallel example here, it'd be like if we already had casino gambling and we lost it tomorrow. That's how much money we're talking about that is at risk now. And so state prosecutors are going to very vigorously appeal this to Supreme Court and remain hopeful that that the state Supreme Court will uphold the tax.
Yeah, so this was a big deal. The Superior Court judge basically agreed with the health providers, saying this isn't fair.
Yeah, that it's discriminatory. We have in our Constitution that you must have equal classes of taxpayers. And the judge essentially said, look, there's rehabilitation services taking place in doctors' offices. They aren't subject to the tax, but at New England Rehab, they are. That's unconstitutional.
Our phone number again for you to join our Friday New Hampshire News Roundup is 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Facebook is NHPR Exchange, all one word. Again, the number 1-800-892-6477. We want your questions and comments about some of the stories that we're covering this week. 1-800-892-6477. And Kathleen, to you first here on the Exchange. We sat down with Governor Hassan on Monday, and she did say that if Republican State Senator Jim Rausch's bill to increase the gas tax came to her desk, she'd sign it. Was there any surprise or reaction over at the State House to that, Kathleen?
I think that she made pretty clear in her State of the State address that she was already behind Senator Rausch's bill. I think really where the uncertainty comes is whether or not this can even get through the Senate. It is a Republican-sponsored bill, but even this week and last week, you saw Republican groups coming out against the bill. The New Hampshire Republican Party came out against it. I think Americans for Prosperity came out against it. So even though it's sponsored by a Republican, doesn't mean that it's drawing large support from Republicans. So I think the biggest hurdle is getting it through the Senate, and we still have to see if that's going to happen. We all know that we desperately need money for our roads and bridges, and I think that's driving the governor's support for this, that it could help bring in some money for infrastructure. But at this point, I would say it still has a ways to go before it gets to her desk.
Yeah, Dean, go ahead, please.
Yeah, the gas tax has been at about, 18 cents since 1991, so we have not had an increase in a long, long time. And so the idea here is that you raise it 4 cents this year, and then it'll be indexed to the consumer price index inflation and reassessed every 4 years. You know, what's interesting to me here is that, we've been trying for over a year now to get Governor Hassan to come out and say she would support a gas tax, and she finally agrees under the cover of essentially a Republican bill in the Senate. But I agree with Kathleen. It's not all clear to me that this is actually going to make it through the Senate.
All right. Again, if you think this is a good idea or not, if you agree with the governor or not, give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. And another State House story, Kevin Landrigan, lots of enthusiasm all of a sudden from all sides of the aisle for Medicaid expansion. What's happening there?
Yeah, this was a signature defeat for Governor Hassan last year. She remains the only Democratic governor in the entire country where her state has not expanded Medicaid. Senate Republicans were insistent that it would be done through the private insurance market. There's been a compromise that's been worked out now. It followed numerous private negotiations between senators and both political parties after, you'll recall, a special session in which Senate Republicans blocked what Governor Hassan wanted. This does something very significant in that it would actually provide health insurance to low-income adults before we receive permission from the federal government to do it the way we want to do it, which is we want to be able to require all of these folks to obtain private health insurance, either through their employer or a private health plan on the Obamacare exchange. So this will start as early as July 1st, this program for up to 50,000 adults who are very low income. If the waiver is not approved by the federal government, 6 months later, the program goes away. If the waiver is approved, the program stays in place, but it sunsets in 3 years at the end of 2016. So it will require a future legislature to endorse this expansion 3 years from now, even if it becomes law. And it looks like it will.
Wow. When we did hear some positive noises, right, Kathleen, from Senate President Chuck Morse this week saying he likes the way this is going. What's ahead for this giant change, Kathleen, in the legislature? And just as this process goes forward, what else needs to happen?
Well, first, obviously, the Republicans and Democrats in the Senate have to get the right people on board to pass this. But the six senators who are supporting this did tell reporters this week that they're both confident that their caucuses will come on board with this and they'll get the support that they need. So then it goes to the House, which the Democratic-led House has been supportive of Medicaid expansion.
That was the first vote they took at the beginning of the year, wasn't
it? Was.
Yeah.
It was. And so I think that, you know, there's confidence that this will be able to get through the House as well. And obviously, as Kevin mentioned, it's something that Governor Hassan really wants. So I think it does have a great chance of getting through the legislature. But as Kevin mentioned, then it's really waiting for the waiver. We have to submit the waiver, and they're trying to get it by March 31st, 2015. So if we can't get it by that deadline, that really kind of changes everything. It decides if we're keeping people on for 3 more months, if we're going to get people insurance for another year and a half. And I also think what's interesting is that, as Kevin mentioned, ultimately the next legislature will have to reapprove this if it works. So theoretically, we could be in a situation where we bring about 50,000 new people onto health insurance plans and then take the money away from them. So I think that's going to be interesting down the line if it does come to that. We have to wait and see. But I think it'll be an interesting fight in the next legislature if this does pass.
Well, and Dean, Kathleen and Kevin have both mentioned the federal government, waivers, pending approval. It seems like the Obama administration really wants states to expand Medicaid as it envisioned under the Affordable Care Act. So it seems like the White House would be open to approving these different ways of approaching expansion.
Right, and just to go back a little bit, this whole issue was a function of the Supreme Court decision upholding the constitutionality of the Affordable Care Act, but the court did say that individual states have the right to opt in or out of the Medicaid expansion. You know, it's interesting. This has been one area in which the Obama administration has claimed some success when they talk about the numbers of individuals now being covered through the various various health exchanges. They often include the many individuals who are now getting this through Medicaid. So in their mind, it's been a success. You know, not all states have adopted it, although some Republican governors have actually been quite quick to adopt the expansion. You know, we've watched this debate carefully now for a year, and you know that special session in November kind of ended in a deadlock. And I look at what this agreement suggests. And it seems to me like Republicans are getting a lot of what they wanted. They basically want to shift the whole focus away from Medicaid managed care into the private insurance market. And I thought it was kind of, you know, from an ideological perspective, I thought it was kind of amusing that the bill is not called Medicaid expansion; it's called health protection. So Republicans don't even want the word Medicaid in the focus of the bill, and that's part of the larger ideological debate over the Affordable Care Act and Medicaid as a government program versus Medicaid as subsidy through the private marketplace.
Well, again, the number, if you want to join us with questions or comments about this Medicaid expansion or whatever terminology you want to use, is 1-800-892-6477. Email is exchange@nhpr.org. Post a comment on our Facebook page if you'd like. NHPR Exchange, you can ask us about Medicaid and some of the other stories we've been following this hour, including the gas tax and the vote to reject expanded background checks for gun purchases. 1-800-892-6477. And Dean, I'm going to throw this next one to you because Kathleen and Kevin both work at newspapers, and this has to do with the health of New Hampshire's newspapers. So I'm going to leave you guys out of it. Dean, there was a strike at the union leader. Workers are still showing up, so it's not that kind of strike, but they're not using their bylines as a way to protest management's latest offer, which cuts benefits, cuts pay deeply. The workers say it would put them back at, you know, levels of pay in the 1990s. What's happening here in the bigger picture?
Well, as we know, anybody who follows newspapers or journalism knows that the business model has really gone through a tough period, both locally and nationally. A lot of newspapers are cutting back staff and coverage. They're downsizing. They're sort of combining resources with some national outlets, et cetera. It's a tough economic environment, and some of that has been driven by the recession, and a lot of it has been driven by just the changing nature in the media environment and figuring out how to transfer from a print-based business model to an internet and technology-based model. So you know, the union leader has been in negotiations with the Manchester Newspaper Guild, which is a union, and they apparently have made some sort of final offer, and the guild felt that, you know, the offer is not acceptable. They say there are steep benefit cuts, loss of job security, and big retroactive pay cuts. So about 40 to 60 protesters were protesting a recent union leader sports banquet. So a very sort of tough negotiation going on right now, but it's symptomatic of larger economic problems in the industry.
All right. And in just a moment, we'll remember poet Maxine Cumin, who died last week. Stay with us.
This is New Hampshire Public Radio, 939. Good morning.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, the Friday News Roundup, the Obama administration delays the ACA employer mandate, and Congress approves a debt ceiling increase. Then a new round of Syrian peace negotiations begins. All coming up on the Diane Rehm Show.
The Diane Rehm Show this morning from 10 till noon on NHPR. Support for NHPR comes from UR members and from the University of New Hampshire, offering a 2-day executive development program to build leadership skills that drive innovation. Program begins March 25th. More at execed.unh.edu. And Harvest Capital, proud sponsor of the UNH Center for Family Business, helping coordinate the 5 steps of successful ownership transition. Information at harvestcap.com. It is 9:40. This is NHPR.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, it's our Friday New Hampshire News Roundup, and we're covering some of the stories that made headlines this week, from bills on background checks for gun purchases to the governor's support for a possible gas tax increase to a story we'll cover in just a moment, the passing away of New Hampshire and National Poet Laureate Maxine Cumin. Let's hear from you, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org. Post a comment on our Facebook page, NHPR Exchange, all one word. Also, on our webpage, you can find a link to interviews with and remembrances of Maxine Cumin, including an interview we did with her back in 2007. Again, the number for you to join us is 1-800-892-6477. Here's an email from Peg in Concord, who says, of course we need an increase in the gas tax. Anyone who drives a car in this state knows it. Glad to see the governor finally taking a stand on something worthwhile. Peg also talks about the gun bill. She says, so sorry, the legislature once again has failed to enact even the most benign law to address gun violence in our society. I'd like to ask you, Kevin Landergan, I think about Peg's middle point there. Glad to see the governor finally taking a stand on something worthwhile. John Lynch was famous for not taking a stand. What about Maggie Hassan?
Yeah, she's got a different style, certainly, than John Lynch. She's more engaging with the legislature than John Lynch was during the process. Former Senate Majority Leader John Lynch had never been a legislator, never had that experience, frankly, never wanted that experience. Maggie Hassan has had it, so she gets in the rough and tumble with them privately, but publicly she's very cautious, much like John Lynch. She gave a State of the State speech we've talked about last week, which was very cautious on a number of subjects. I support a minimum wage increase, but legislature, you figure out what the number should be. She doesn't defer to the legislature, but she has a lot of respect for that process and often doesn't try to dictate what it should do.
So she's got a little bit more of a style of where she's willing to get in there and say what she thinks.
Yes, and particularly with them privately, and they really appreciate it. Legislators in both parties have told me that privately they like the fact that this I can go in with this governor, close the door, and get an answer from her. I couldn't do that with John Lynch all the time.
Thanks for the email, Peg. And here's another one from Suzanne, who says, the House Criminal Justice Committee voted Tuesday 14-3 to repeal the death penalty. Several members who had previously supported the death penalty voted for repeal after hearing the testimony. Suzanne says the death penalty is applied unequally, is not an effective deterrent, is expensive, is morally wrong. You're right, Suzanne. That committee did vote that way. You're absolutely right. She asks, what are the prospects in the full House vote next Wednesday and in the Senate? Did you cover that, Kathleen, the death penalty issue in the State House?
I was at the Criminal Justice Committee hearing when they made that vote, and it was interesting. Several lawmakers who changed their mind made it clear. They clearly expressed why they were changing their mind before they took that vote. Some notable ones were Majority Leader Steve Shurtleff. He talked about how he's historically been opposed to a death penalty repeal. Even as recently as 2009, he was on a commission to study the death penalty. And he said that, you know, he really thinks it's time to change the law here in New Hampshire. He said he thinks it's a barbaric practice and we need to change it. The committee chairwoman, Laura Panalakos, also said that she changed her mind and she brought up this point that she believes it's applied unequally. And she referenced Michael Addison, who is on death row, versus some other white criminals in the past who have not been put on death row. And that caused her to change her mind. So I think it seems like there is a shift going on for some of these staunch opponents in the past to change their mind. So I think, you know, going into the full House, I think that it probably has a decent chance of passing, given that the House is led by Democrats. And we've already heard from some major opponents changing their mind that we could definitely see it get through the full House, I think. Again, the Senate is always another question.
Open question. All right. Well, I did want to ask you, Kevin Landergan, about Maxine Cumin. This happened about a week ago, last Thursday, actually, and we didn't follow up on it in last week's Friday New Hampshire News Roundup. I was very sad to hear the news about the passing of Maxine Cumin, National Poet Laureate, New Hampshire Poet Laureate. I was lucky enough to interview Maxine several times. I loved talking to her. What are your own memories of Maxine Cumin and what she meant to the state, Kevin?
Yeah, I mean, that's what you have to start out with, okay? Which is Massachusetts has David Thoreau and New Hampshire has Maxine Cumin. I mean, that's, to me, she's not a national treasure. She's a New Hampshire treasure. And people in this state of arts and letters put her on a pedestal where there is no peer. I mean, she wrote about nature in a way that was just so inspiring, and This was someone who chose New Hampshire as her home, and I think that's what endeared her so much to people here, that she grew up in Washington, D.C. Her family lived for some time in New York. But she wanted to get out in the country and experience the country so she could write about nature, and she moved to Warner, New Hampshire. And even when she was in Washington, just incredible stories about her going down to the Potomac River to feed and water her horse that she had there. Think about that during that time.
She had a terrible accident on that horse when she was in her later years.
Right,
yeah.
She did.
And she recovered.
She did recover. Won the Pulitzer Prize for the Upcountry Poems of New England back in 1973. But I think this is the other thing people who know about her life really respect, which is she wrote a lot about nature and she was very smart. But she was also very opinionated, and she had very deep thoughts on the issues of the day. As we heard in some of the interviews that you had done with her, Laura, she was, I consider her certainly a pioneer feminist in the country when it was not at all fashionable to talk about women's equality, both in the workplace and everywhere. She was very forthright and had very strong opinions and respectful of people's rights. But not afraid to speak her mind.
Well, again, if you want to hear some of Maxine, you can go to our webpage, nhpr.org. You can find a link to interviews with her, remembrances of her. And I believe in some of those interviews, I did get her to read some of her poetry, of course. Yes. So she was always great about that. Well, that's a loss, definitely, for all of us here in New Hampshire. I wanted to ask you, Dean Spiliotis, about a happier story. You're a dog person, so this one's for you. New Hampshire had a unique role in this year's Westminster Dog Show in New York City. This has to do with the Chinook, New Hampshire's official state dog. Now, first of all, I just have to ask you this. A lot of states have official, you know, flowers or trees. Do most states have official state dogs, Dean?
I do not know. I did not know that we had an official state dog. I now know that.
Because then you have to have an official state cat,
yes,
just for equality.
I'm sure cat owners are on top of that if it already isn't the case. Yeah, you know, I did learn that the Chinook is New Hampshire's official state dog. But the interesting thing is that for the first time in its 138-year history, the Westminster Kennel Club, which has this big dog show at Madison Square Garden every year, allowed the Chinook into the competition. And we had one dog from Londonderry Burr as a 5-year-old Chinook who competed, won best of breed, at the show, which is great, then went on to the next level, which, and I've seen conflicting reports about whether the Chinook is in the sporting group or the working group, but in any event, did not place in the group level, which then the winner of the group goes on to the best in show, which is the top dog in each of the, you know, the working group, sporting group, herding group, et cetera, et cetera. So a good showing nonetheless for the Chinook. It's a handsome-looking dog if you get a chance to see Burr on the web. So that is pretty neat. And there have been some other changes in recent years to the rules about mixed breeds and agility tests and whatnot. I think the show is trying to sort of adapt a little bit with changing tastes in dogs.
And I'm guessing you saw that movie Best in Show.
Several times.
Here's an email that came in from John in Keene. John, thank you for this one. He says, I want to take issue with the guest's statement that the hospitals were all right with the tax, meaning the Medicaid enhancement tax, when it was proposed. John says it was initially opposed by the providers on the grounds that the reimbursement formula could change to their detriment. John says it was reluctantly accepted after the hospitals were assured the formula would never change. Kevin, this was a little bit of history that you were giving us earlier on the Medicaid enhancement tax.
Yeah, and certainly hospital executives have always been wary about it. And every year, almost every 2 years, the legislature had to, through the budget process, had to re-promise to the hospitals, we're going to pay all the money back, don't worry. So John is right. They've always been wary about it, and probably and many of them privately, many hospital executives have told me privately through the years, they thought this was inevitable. Meant that New Hampshire would try.
So they were always a little nervous about this.
Very.
Okay. Let's take a call if we could. And Melissa is waiting in Newcastle. Hey, Melissa, thanks for hanging on. You're on the air. Go ahead.
Hi, thank you. I would just like to call and state that I feel that your reporting on the House bill requiring criminal background checks is inaccurate. It's inaccurate to state that the bill was heartily or soundly defeated. There were actually 6 or 7 votes that day. The first one was to table the vote, and that was defeated. The second vote, the bill actually passed, but there was another vote submitted that would be an amendment to place the legislation with a study committee. That was defeated. There was another attempt to table the legislation. At the end, it was a very confusing vote and a very confusing strategy that ultimately worked for the opposition to defeat the vote. But I don't think it's fair to say that it was heartily defeated. I think it was defeated in a tricky way.
Sure. Melissa, it was confusing. You're so right. Thank
yes,
you for calling.
It really was. Thank
yeah.
you, Laura.
No, thank you very much. And boy, she's right. And I apologize if we didn't represent it in the right way. But it sounds like it was kind of tricky down there, Kathleen.
Yes, she's definitely right that it was very complicated. And as Kevin mentioned earlier, most of these votes weren't recorded votes. So we don't know how people voted. And they wanted it that way so that their names wouldn't be attached to it. But because of that, it's hard to figure out exactly what each vote meant. But I do just want to note that the second vote wasn't the bill passing. It was the House voting to accept an amendment which changed the bill so that it would be only apply to commercial sales. Basically, they were amending the bill so that if you wanted to sell to someone that you knew personally, this wouldn't affect you. So they were voting to accept that amendment. They weren't voting to pass the bill. But she is right that it was very tricky, and it's hard to come out and specifically say, you know, this is a sound defeat for gun background checks, because you'll talk to a lot of people who wanted background checks who don't feel that it was a major defeat.
Wow. Okay. Well, again, Melissa, thank you very much for calling in. Kevin Landrigan, some happy news up north. Possible new purchase of the Balsams, which has been sitting empty and closed for at least a year, Kevin. And I think this might be the second winter that they haven't had folks up there enjoying the beautiful skiing and snowshoeing and woods that they have.
Yeah. And certainly in the winter where I think we can agree we've gotten enough snow and getting more snow this weekend.
enough, maybe more than enough.
The Balsams really is an iconic institution, a great ski area, a great resort, and a kind of interesting, kind of almost ironic player has emerged now. Les Auten, who is the former part owner of the Red Sox, and I say ironic because Les Auten had a skiing empire that was across the country. He owned a lot of Western resorts. But he made Sunday River in Bethel, Maine, right over the New Hampshire border in Maine, into a magnet for skiing. He was really on the cutting edge of understanding that we have to make these ski areas year-round destinations. He did the water slide, really high-end restaurants, a lot of family daycare services. In other words, stole a lot of business from the Loons, the Waterville Valleys, the Wildcats from New Hampshire.
Uh-huh.
And to have him now step in, he got overextended in the 1990s, sought financial protection, but we're told has liquidated or sold most of those properties he had formerly owned and financially had some resources. Sold his part ownership in the Red Sox, which, by the way, netted him a nice tidy sum. So he's got interest. But as your opener stated, you know, it's trust but verify up in the North Country. They really want the Balsams to reopen in a big way.
Sure, lots of jobs connected with that facility.
Lots of jobs. A good deal of reinvestment could be required. So they want to see this come to fruition before they actually believe it's going to happen.
All right. Well, a story that our reporters in the North Country will definitely be following. One last story that caught our eye this week, Travel and Leisure magazine, just in time for Valentine's Day, Dean, named Portsmouth one of the top 10 romantic cities in the country. Now, what did the good editors at Travel and Leisure say about our fair port city?
Well, they did say it was the ninth most romantic city in the U.S. They cited things like the music hall. They cited the craft beer scene in Portsmouth. You know, and I think anybody who's been there can talk about the sea coast and kind of the historic nature of the city, some great restaurants and other types of entertainments there. And so it is interesting. When I talk to people who are passing through New Hampshire, they often either remark on how much they were surprised and enjoyed Portsmouth, or they are in fact, coming up to New Hampshire to go to Portsmouth. So it seems like there's a lot going on over there, and I think this is a very nice gift to them for the local tourism and Chamber of Commerce.
Just in time for Valentine's Day. And again, they were rated 9 out of the top 10 most romantic cities in the country. I love what Valerie Rochon, tourism director for the city, said. We should have ranked higher, she said. So good for good for her. Well, next week on The Exchange, on Thursday, we'll be sitting down with 2nd District Congresswoman Anne McLean Custer. She'll be with us so listeners can get their questions in for the Congresswoman before the show by email or by Facebook. That's Thursday on The Exchange. Kathleen, what will you be covering next week?
On Tuesday, the Senate Health, Education, and Human Services Committee is going to hold a hearing on the Medicaid expansion bill at 9:15 a.m. So that's definitely going to be interesting to see who comes out for that, what they have to say. And they're actually expected to vote on the bill that day. So the committee is expected to vote. So you can see that the Senate is trying to move this through as quickly as possible so that it can get to the House, get to the governor's desk. So I think that's going to be a big thing to watch, 9:15 on Tuesday.
Okay. Wow. Kevin, how about you?
Yeah, interesting issue with abortion rights impact confronts the state Senate next Wednesday. Whether to allow and require a buffer zone around abortion clinics in the parking lots, the entrances, and the exits. What's interesting about this is we're waiting on the U.S. Supreme Court to rule on the constitutionality of a 35-foot buffer zone in Massachusetts. This bill would have a 25-foot buffer. It stands a chance of getting support in the state Senate because it has bipartisan support. We'll see next week.
Okay. And Dean, you?
I think next week this Medicaid hearing and vote is going to be very important. You know, we've been watching this for over a year. It'll be interesting to see how quickly and effectively they can move this through both houses of the state legislature, and also just to kind of whet your appetite a little bit, some 2016 action. We're going to have in the coming weeks, Rand Paul, Ted Cruz, Bobby Jindal,
wow,
all perennial presidential hopefuls are going to be back in the state. So always look forward to that.
I know you'll have tickets to that, Dean.
Absolutely.
All right. Well, happy Valentine's Day, y'all. We're going to close out with Duke Ellington playing My Funny Valentine. Thanks for being here.
Thank you, Laura.
Thank you.
This is The Exchange on NHPR.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you missed any part of today's program, listen to The Exchange anytime at nhpr.org.
Every weekday at 9 a.m., The Exchange examines the issues that concern you. The ones you talk about around the water cooler or at the breakfast table. Our focus is the news of the day, be it politics, education, or the environment. We bring you conversations about events half a world away or just down the street. I'm Laura Kanoy. Join me for The Exchange, weekday mornings at 9 on NHPR.
This is New Hampshire Public Radio with the Diane Rehm Show, next at 10 o'clock. Support for NHPR comes from UR members and from Heritage Plumbing, Heating, Cooling, Electric, now offering electrical repair and service, in addition to furnaces, boilers, and water heaters, online at justcallheritage.com. And Centrix Bank, see beyond with Centrix Bank, banking solutions customized to your business, information available at centrixbank.com.
These are the stations of New Hampshire Public Radio, WEVO, Concord, 89.1,
WEVS, Nashua,
88.3, WEVH, Hanover,
91.3, WEVN, Keene,
90.7,
WEVC, Gorham,
107.1, WEVJ, Jackson,
99.5,
WEVF, Colebrook,
90.3.
And WEVQ Littleton,
91.9, and online at nhpr.org.
It's 10 o'clock.
From WAMU and NPR in Washington, I'm Diane Rehm. For the first time since 2009, Congress passes a debt ceiling bill without strings attached. The extension is a blow to Tea Party Republicans who oppose an increase in federal borrowing. The Obama administration announces another